everyone. It's very good to be here with such a terrific panel to talk about what remains, sadly, a very central issue across all Guantanamo Bay. We're talking specifically tonight, the subject is, as you know, is the banned books of Guantanamo. And as you will know, Guantanamo marked its 13th anniversary in January. What we're going to start by talking about is censorship. And that's how and why the authorities control information and books going into Guantanamo, and what that can actually tell us about the system and the thinking that created the camp and runs the camp. We only know about the ban on books because of the list that Clive Stafford Smith, who's the director founder of Reprieve, he released a list over a year ago that showed the most extraordinary, apparently arbitrary, range of books that were banned from Guantanamo, that ranged from all poetry to the Bible to Puss in Boots, but apparently 1984 and Kafka's trial were allowed in. So we're going to try and see if we can make any sense of that at all. Censorship has been absolutely integral to US operations since 9/11, and it's censorship that's been very key to allowing the abuse of prisoners and also concealing that abuse. And it's part of what's been essential, allowing the secrecy to exist that has allowed Guantanamo to carry on for as long as it has. And it was actually 4 years before the names of the prisoners being held there was released. But we should also look at the censorship on the information that comes out of Guantanamo, as well as the information that is stopped from going in, and have a look at what it's actually taken to expose a hidden camp that exists outside the law. And obviously then I think we should all talk about what it's going to take to close Guantanamo and why Obama has so signally failed to keep the promise that he made in the first year that he became president. So let me introduce the panel. Sitting next to me is Ian Cobain, who is a writer and journalist from The Guardian, an investigative reporter. His work has included an examination of the UK's involvement in the unlawful detention and mistreatment of detainees since 9/11 and in Iraq following the invasion in 2003. He's won many awards for his work, including the Martha Gellhorn Prize, the Paul Foote Award, and a number of Amnesty International Media Awards, a Human Rights Award from Liberty, and a Political Book Award. And his book, Cruel Britannia, A Secret History of Torture, is, as you might expect, banned in Guantanamo.
And on sale outside.
And it's on sale outside, it's not banned here. Yeah. Praise the Lord. Claire Algar, sitting next to Ian, is Executive Director of Reprieve, an organisation that many of you will know provides, very importantly, free legal and investigative support to those facing execution and victimised by states' abusive counter-terror policies. Reprieve played a very important role in Guantanamo, currently representing 12 prisoners, and it provides legal assistance to many more. It also led the fight for access to the men held at Guantanamo and was one of the very first organisations that was actually allowed inside. Since then, it secured freedom for 69 men illegally detained without charge or trial, more than any other law firm or NGO, which is remarkable work. Sitting next to Claire is Andy Worthington, who is a journalist, an activist, an author, photographer, filmmaker, and a singer-songwriter as well. He is the co-founder of the Close Guantanamo campaign, the co-director of We Stand With Shaka, calling for the immediate release from Guantanamo of Shaka Amer, the last British resident who's been held there. Andy's also the author of the Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. He's written two other books about British counterculture. He's the director, co-director of the documentary film Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo, and he's written for the New York Times, The Guardian, and has worked with the UN, WikiLeaks, and Reprieve. So please welcome them. I thought I'd just tell you first some of the other books that are banned in Guantanamo. Martin Amis's Money, John Grisham, The Innocent Man, William Shakespeare, The Merchant of Venice, Dostoevsky, Crime and Punishment, Frederick Forsyth, The Kill List, Russell Brand, Bookie Book 2. Solzhenitsyn, Gulag Archipelago, and Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin. So the question I kind of want to ask Andy, I think, first, is considering what Guantanamo is and what it represents, why then go to the trouble of banning books?
Well, I think, you know, I think at the beginning everything was banned at Guantanamo. It's important to remember that when the men first arrived in those orange jumpsuits with their eyes and their ears covered on January 11th, 2002, they were held in what really looked like kind of animal cages that the Marines had swiftly built to hold them, where they were held for months until the first more permanent structures were erected. And the initial plan on the part of the US establishment was to not let them talk to each other at all, ever, and to not let them have any kind of possessions. It was to keep them in a total state of silence and dependency on their captors. And obviously, as time went on, that absolute prohibition on them having anything broke down in various ways so that things started to be allowed in. And one of the things that eventually the prisoners got access to, although I don't know when that first happened, but it would certainly have taken time. And to this day, things are dependent on whether prisoners are perceived as cooperative or not. If you're perceived as an uncooperative prisoner, you really don't get any of the comforts. I think recently Shaka Armahat was prohibited from calling his family for about 18 months because he'd been misbehaving. They didn't like how he was behaving, so they wouldn't let him talk to his family. You know, those kind of things have only happened over the last few years. So the books were something that arrived at some point during the Guantanamo story, which is now 13 years old in its 14th year. And as with everything, it involves elements of control on the part of the US military. It's not their business to be opening things up so that the prisoners can have whatever they want. Similarly, you know, people who send letters to the prisoners need to be aware that not everything will get through to them. You know, they're just issues of control all the time. So that doesn't explain the seeming lack of logic in some of the choices that are made. And you know, maybe we could attribute that to certain levels of incompetence, which hopefully we'll discuss more. But I would just add as well, if I may, though it's a plug very early on, that my book, The Guantanamo Files, though I haven't seen it on any official list, is banned at Guantanamo. I'd be very surprised if it isn't banned at Guantanamo. The two best comments I've ever received about my book are from former prisoners. One is from Mozambique, who said, I go to Andy's book when I want to know who I was in Guantanamo with. Mm-hmm. And the other was from Omar de Gaez, former British prisoner, who has said to me, it felt like you were there with us, which is the absolute highest praise that I could have. Mm-hmm. But I am pretty sure that they hadn't let the book in, because...
No, it would be surprising.
Do you think, Claire, that the extraordinarily arbitrary list of books that are banned, it is just an indication of the arbitrary abuse of power?
It's very difficult to say, isn't it? I mean, the books that are so extraordinary, you know, so you've got Puss in Boots, and I think probably Reprieve has to take some responsibility for this, because I expect that it was Clive who tried to get Puss in Boots in. Indeed. And it resulted in it being banned. Jack and the Beanstalk, also not allowed. And Clive has great fun imagining that might be something to do with the sort of escape plan. And the prisoners might be thinking that if they got some magic beans, there might be some... and then there was some long joke about... Bishr al-Rawi was very keen on running, and so Clive tried to take him Runners Weekly, which was immediately banned. But Swimming Times got in. And so there's this whole sort of thing that goes, well, you've got a large number of guards and then the world's second largest landmine field between Guantanamo and freedom if you're running. But if you're swimming, really not so bad. Just dive into the Caribbean. Anyway, so it is obviously completely random, and I think there's possibly there seem to be sort of different things at play. So I believe that Russell Brand's Bookie Wook was banned because of the foul language. In fact, I understand that, I'm just not going to say it out loud, but anyway, that there were words on the front page which the guards decided should not be allowed to be viewed by the Guantanamo prisoners. Ditto train spotting was not allowed in. And there's a rather wonderful bit. It's probably too early to read bits out, but I shall anyway. Which the train spotting author said in response to his book being banned. He said, "I really don't know why my work is banned there. Prisoners in Guantanamo Bay are hardly going to read train spotting and say, 'Right, I'm going to go out and take loads of heroin.' Perhaps it would be a good thing for the establishment if they did. Stop them dropping bombs or whatever it is they stand accused of planning to do," which is rather great. Yeah, I mean, there's so much of it that seems incredibly arbitrary. The other thing, I've got a kind of stream of consciousness thing going on here, but I'm facing the iguana at the back, and we should all take a moment to, first of all, appreciate the very beautiful iguana at the back. But secondly, when we went out to Guantanamo, we discovered that iguanas had significant rights, because if you hit an iguana in a military vehicle, you had a $50,000 fine for injuring the iguana, because they're a protected species out there, probably very rightly so. And so we started a campaign of give our clients the same rights as iguanas, which was enjoyable, but didn't really get us very much other than some news coverage, but it was fun. I'll come back to broad full-spectrum dominance, maybe.
Yes, well, you've said it now.
I said it now. Okay, I'm going to sound like a lunatic, but bear with me here. I think that the book banning is basically part of this concept of full-spectrum dominance. Full-spectrum dominance is, many of you may know, a US military concept, and it involves ownership of the entire battle space. So you own the terrestrial space, you own the marine space, you own the aerial space, and the concept also is that you own the psychological or informational space. And it is apparently the US's Army's strategy to adopt or gain full-spectrum dominance in all combat zones that they engage in. And it feels to me as though book banning is simply very much a part of that. It's a sort of steroidal attempt to define the terms of debate. And I think it comes into the same area as the sort of Orwellian redefinition of terms. So, you know, using extraordinary rendition to mean kidnap, and using manipulative self-injurious behaviour to mean suicide attempt. And, you know, I mean, so there are, you know, I think it's a part of the same thing, of the same attempt to control.
Fear is also a reason, Ian, isn't it, for regimes or authorities to ban books, the fear that information, how information might be used. And your book obviously is full of information that could be, your book which is banned in Guantanamo could be, it's full of information that I imagine the Americans would rather people in Guantanamo didn't know.
Well, yes, the United States was a very fearful state, wasn't it, after 9/11. It was very worried about what would happen next, and didn't understand its enemy, and wanted to find out more through whatever means it could. And you can see that a state which feels terribly insecure is likely to want to suppress free speech, free thought amongst those it perceives as being its enemies. And that might explain. I think Claire's explanation helps us to understand what happens. But some of the decisions that's been made by censors just leave me utterly bewildered. I can't understand, for example, why American censors would want to ban Paine's The Rights of Man. I just don't get it. And and Frank's diary. I mean, that's just really disturbing, the idea that... Does that tell us something about what the Guantanamo authorities actually think about themselves at times, that they've decided they can't countenance having Anne Frank's diary in their prison? But, that bewilders me. But I also wonder whether... one of the problems that the Guantanamo authorities have is... the occasional recognition that they are holding human beings and mistreating human beings in this way, and if they dehumanise their inmates, then it makes it so much easier for them to go about their duties, to get through their day. And it's hard to maybe denying people the opportunity to read poetry, for example, dehumanises them to some degree. Mm.
So there is, for example, this is also information that Clive Stafford Smith has unearthed, that there is actually the Department of Defence has a policy not to approve any poetry being allowed into Guantanamo. This is based on an analysis of risk of both content and format. So the idea, which is remarkable. Also, there was a prisoner who asked for the Bible His lawyer gave a copy to the chaplain and was then given a dressing down about the potentially fatal breach of prison discipline that would be caused by the Bible being given, handed over. So it is all most bewildering. And obviously bewildering, and we all recognise the complete denial of human rights that Guantanamo represents from a country that supposedly has been a great emblem of human rights and, above all, freedom of expression. So this is, you know, another indication of this total subversion of support for human rights.
Yeah. They have always thought that poetry is full of coded messages, though. Eight years ago, a US lawyer put together a book of poems written by the authorities, by the prisoners, which the authorities were terrified of allowing to be released because they just thought that there were hidden messages that Al-Qaeda would be picking up in the context of poetry. I think they can somehow be less perturbed by prose.
To be fair, poetry is powerful stuff. I mean, if you're going to start like randomly outlawing a particular mode of writing, I'd probably go with poetry.
One thing I thought interesting is that my organisation, PEN, we do a lot of work in prisons, and we send writers into prisons to work with people. And we have a prison competition every year, a prison writing competition. And one of the winners last year wrote to me and said that, this incredibly moving letter about how poetry had been a complete lifesaver for him, and he'd won, been highly commended for this review he'd written for the competition about Philip Larkin, and he came up with this completely brilliant idea, which is something that I still want to do, which is that he thought, you know, when you go into prison, you get given some kind of manual free, which is, I don't know, how to mindfulness, meditation, or the best exercises you can do in a small space, or whatever it is. And he said, actually, what would be amazing would be if every prisoner was given a book of poetry that was chosen by prisoners, for prisoners. And so I'm still trying to make that happen and to sort of put together a panel of prisoners as editors to select these poems. It's something I very much want to do. But it obviously shows that whoever came out with this extraordinary total ban clearly realised the incredible power of poetry.
Well, you'd have to get away from the notion of punishment in general in prisons, which so many people have fixated on, to have a book that would actually help people.
Yes.
The thing with Guantanamo was not that it was a prison as such, as that it was a place where they were isolating the prisoners. And then to go, I think, with Claire's full spectrum dominance is the dehumanising of prisoners that specifically took place. I mean, through the CIA's programme, which hopefully we all heard about in the executive summary of the CIA torture report that came out just before Christmas, we heard there about how two military psychologists had reverse-engineered their programme, which was to train US military personnel to resist torture if they were captured by a hostile enemy. And so they reverse engineered that for real life interrogations. And the core of what they were doing was called learned helplessness, which is where you make prisoners' entire lives, everything in their lives, dependent on their guards. And that's really kind of how Guantanamo started. It started in isolation. They wanted people not to communicate with each other at all, because they had this notion that they would interrogate them for as long as they felt like it, and that they would build up a mosaic of intelligence. God knows, this could have involved every Muslim on earth if they'd really gone for it, and holding them forever in the notion that they would get bits and pieces of this bigger picture that would come together. But, you know, as we know, things became slightly less inhuman as time developed, so that things were allowed in. But that's been very much coming from a position where nothing was allowed, to somewhere where they've actually got access to things. But the issue of incompetence is something that it's important, I think, because if we look at the book issue in relation to the general issue of intelligence that has come out of Guantanamo, every single word that the prisoners say to their lawyers, and this is you know, basically the way that they can try and communicate with the world. Lawyers have been able to go and see them since late 2004, early 2005. When they meet their clients, they write down the notes of what the clients say to them. Every word that takes place is presumptively classified. So lawyers can, for example, come home, they're with their partner, say, "How was it at Guantanamo?" Can't speak anything about it. That's not allowed. What has to happen is that it then goes through a Pentagon review process. I can't remember the exact name of that. Can you remember it, Claire? The Privilege Board. Privilege Review Board. They go through the notes and decide whether it can be unclassified or whether it remains classified. And if it's unclassified, it's released to the lawyers and they can then publicize it. Well, from the beginning of this process, I have to say, really damning accounts from the prisoners have been unclassified by the censorship board, which you wouldn't do if you were running a really 100% effective lockdown of information. It's part of where the monstrosity that is Guantanamo meets the checks and balances of the US system. And it's clearly because the people that are doing these jobs are not necessarily any good at them. They just happen to have got a job with them, with the Department of Defense. They happen to have got assigned to this place where they're supposed to decide whether things are censored or not, and they actually don't know what they're doing. So things get out, and from the beginning, a lot of really damning information has come out. So I see the book issue really as being related to that, but there's a lot of incompetence going on. Mm.
So that brings us to this remarkable book that has just been published that was written by a prisoner in Guantanamo, Mohamed Ould Slahi, from Mauritania, who's been held for 13 years and has actually been, his habeas corpus petition was granted 5 years ago. The government then appealed it. He is still there. English was his fourth language. He mostly learnt it in Guantanamo, despite the fact actually that another of the things that is banned is materials that help you to learn English. So what a remarkable man. And there he would, his lawyer had to fight for more than 6 years to get the manuscript released so that it could be published as a book. And Ian, the Guardian did a fantastic job publishing the manuscript. How much did it reveal, do you think, about what goes on inside Guantanamo?
It revealed an extraordinary amount about what goes on inside Guantanamo and told us more about the awful interrogation techniques that were being inflicted upon people like Mohamed Ould Slahi. I have to say it tells us more about that individual than it does about Guantanamo. It is a remarkable book for those who haven't read it. It's an absolutely remarkable book. It's published in redacted form, you know, so a lot of it's blacked out because that's the way his lawyer was able to obtain to bring it out into the public domain, but it was redacted before. If he's ever released, and I hope he will be, then maybe we'll have an unredacted version of the book. And maybe it's going to be a very different book. But it tells us an extraordinary amount about the resilience, really, of one individual. And as Joe said, it's his fourth language, and he largely learnt it after arriving at Guantanamo. He's obviously an incredibly smart guy. He describes being flown from Bagram to Guantanamo, and the plane arrives, and the guards are shouting at him, "Don't talk! No talking!" And he immediately thinks, there's two ways of saying that. Don't talk and no talking. And he's absorbing it all. And eventually he wrote this book. It's all written by hand. And he was giving his notes over to his lawyer every time he met his lawyer. And it was presumptively classified. Eventually, it took us 6 years to get it declassified, but redacted. So it's a remarkable prison memoir. It's a great book.
Mm. It's not directly on point, but it's a rather depressing fact, which is that when we started this work, which was obviously quite some years ago, we spent a vast amount on translators. It was one of the significant lines of our Guantanamo budget, and now we basically don't need translators because all the guys have learned English, which is just very depressing. But I was going to say something on the dehumanisation point that both Andy and Ian made, which is that it was that there was actually a case relating to this, which is a further example of the crazy, where you may remember there was a case called Hobby Lobby, where the US court held that Hobby Lobby, a corporation, was in fact a person for various reasons, and it was all a bit random, and everybody was sort of like, really? No, not really a person, a corporation. at the same time, we were bringing some litigation around sort of religious freedoms and specifically the right not to be force-fed if one were hunger-striking, because a lot of the guys in Guantanamo ended up hunger-striking as a way to peacefully protest the fact that, despite the fact a bunch of them had been cleared for release for a really long time, no one was going home. And the court, in response to that, there was a very clear remedy under the Act, which said, you know, a person to whom this happens has a remedy and it has to stop. And the way that the court got around that was by saying that actually the people in Guantanamo didn't classify as people. And you know, there was a, I think it was a sort of legal wiggle, because they obviously didn't want to find, they didn't want to find that the guards in Guantanamo couldn't behave in this way, but it was a really unappetizing way of wriggling out of it. The other story I was going to tell briefly was the story of how we got into Guantanamo in the first place, because again, it's an example of the crazy, which was that the Bush administration wouldn't publish a list of the people who were in Guantanamo, and this comes back to the point that Joe was making about information not leaving Guantanamo, and Andy. So we said, well, we'd like to act for these guys. And they said, well, you can't, because you haven't got authorization from them. And we said, well, we can't get authorization from them because we don't know who they are. If we did know who they were, we could ask their family for a sort of next friend authorization. And they said, well, we're not telling you who they are, so you can't ask their family. And so we did this sort of reverse engineering thing where we went to parts of the Middle East and North Africa and Afghanistan and said, anyone disappeared recently? Anyone know anyone who you think might be in Guantanamo? And we basically made the list that we thought existed, went to their families and got authorizations from them to act for them, if which we didn't know they happened to be in Guantanamo, and then sent all of those into the State Department.
How many were there?
Quite a few. And the cool thing is, you only need one, because once you're in, you can get authorizations from
all
the
others. That's how you started the work.
Yep.
That's extraordinary. How long did it take to get those? Numbers?
4 years.
4 years.
Yeah. Took a while to get in. But
that's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And you've been to Guantanamo?
I haven't, no. I am not security cleared. Partly because I'm not an American lawyer. But we have three lawyers who go to Gitmo at the moment. Yeah.
On the point of dehumanisation, one of the remarkable things is in Mohammed Al-Sulahi's book is the humanity, isn't it? I mean, that is the book is a quite horrifying catalogue of torture, and at the end of it, he says, he talks about wanting to sit down and have a cup of tea, and tea is one of his favourite things. It's very charming over and over in the book. There's a celebration of tea.
Man should come to England.
And so there can be no higher compliment from him than to have a cup of tea with anyone. But he says at the end he wants to have a cup of tea with his captors, and that's extraordinary.
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, I think the humanity of so many of the people who've been held has been like that, the people that I've met. I mean, it's an extraordinary account of... It's so detailed about the monstrous people he was up against who were coming up with, whether instructed or given a certain amount of license, were trying to work out ways to destroy him, you know, were full of absolute contempt for him, regarded him as the worst of the worst, as they had been told, without that really actually genuinely being based on anything. And as we've seen, this is a man who, against whom there appears to be no case.
Yeah,
as the judge decided, I think it might have been Colonel Morris Davis, who was the former chief prosecutor of the military commissions at Guantanamo, who resigned when he was put in a chain of command under this Pentagon senior lawyer who approved the use of torture, which Colonel Morris Davis didn't. I think he described him as a Zelig-like figure because he's, you know, he is related to the spiritual advisor of Al-Qaeda, a man who opposed 9/11. He was in Germany. He met some of the 9/11 hijackers. But so he keeps turning up where there is a story of something, which was why the suspicions arose in the first place. But he actually knew nothing. And yet, here were these people doing awful things with different people, different groups of people, different variations of how they could try and destroy him, and he wasn't destroyed. And his use of English is amazing, because when I was reading my book, I went through the transcripts from Guantanamo, and he was already, you know, it didn't take him long to pick up English. The line he said about how the Mauritanians handed him over to the Americans were, he said, My country handed me over like a candy bar to the United States. Mm. Just amazing yeah. phrase.
Mm. Mm. Anyway. It's very restrained, very calm, but and it's full of humour as well, isn't
yes.
it? It is a very good book, and it's worth mentioning the fact that it's banned at Guantanamo. He can't see yeah. his own book, and his fellow inmates can't read it.
Yeah. Mm. So, I mean, the whole... Going back to this question about how you get the information, and obviously since 9/11, with all the secrecy around rendition, the path that has led so many to Guantanamo, the collusion of the British, the involvement of other countries... For you, Ian, it's become obviously one of the main subjects that you've been writing about, and you've written a book about it. And I'm wondering we know, for example, in the States that the Freedom of Information Act has been used to release a lot of the information that is now in the public domain. What kind of tools have you used to get the information?
Well, the UK Freedom of Information Act is next to useless
yeah.
in this respect when investigating allegations of wrongdoing by the state, because there's 20-odd exemptions which are designed to prevent information of that nature from being made public. In fact, the situation is probably slightly worse following the introduction of the Act than it was before, for various sort of technical legal reasons. One of the things I would do is I'd try and build up a pattern by talking to victims of rendition or their families and their lawyers, and see if there was a pattern emerging of any sort. And very often they would say that when they were being interrogated by British intelligence officers, they'd introduce themselves using the same form of words. And after a while, you could then put the allegations to the government and then watch them evade your questions and issue blanket denials mm. and avoid the specifics, mm. which was very, very revealing. And occasionally you could talk to them privately and they could be really quite candid. Some quite senior people would be quite candid in their admissions about what they were doing. Mm. So that was one
unexpected.
Of the...
Unexpected.
Completely unexpected.
Why do you think they were?
Because during the same conversations they were stressed... the difficulties of their work and the threats mm. the country was facing, and hoped that our questions would go away.
Mm. I think there's a belief thing. I mean, I remember a guy from MI6 coming to talk to us, and he said, you have to understand that, you know, you guys think that you believe in this cause, we also believe in this cause. And so it's almost a sort of, in the same way as Reprieve is, you know, full of a bunch of idealistic activists, I think that there is a real belief that actually not that they're always doing the right thing, but that they're in service of a goal, which I guess they are. So mm-hmm. I think that there's a sort of pride, and it's the thing we were talking about upstairs earlier around we have to take intelligence from countries that torture, because it would be completely irresponsible of us not to do that. And actually, you know, what are we going to do if Pakistan's telling us that they've tortured someone and that person who's been tortured is giving us this information? Are we supposed to say, tell us no more, because we suspect or believe or know that he's been tortured? And so I think that that's sort of stopped now, because with all the cases that have been brought against them, they sort of realise they can't really say that sort of thing quite so much. But I think that there is a real...
It must be said, I think, that, you know, if you are presented with evidence that you're pretty sure was derived through the use of torture, you should be as wary as possible of accepting it. I mean, one of the things that we've seen through the revelations of the US torture programme, which have been public knowledge for quite a few years, actually... From the FBI in particular, at one point the FBI's director complained publicly via a journalist that the agency had spent a vast amount of manpower chasing wild goose chases, false leads, that had been produced as a result of the torture of Abu Zubaydah, who was waterboarded 83 times and almost destroyed completely as a person, I think, as a result of what happened, but who also told lies repeatedly, which then... Some of these things may have been true, but everything had to be checked out. So the FBI wasted God knows how much time and resources chasing false leads.
And Al Libby. I mean, this is, I think, denied by the US government, but Al Libby said during his torture, and, you know, he definitely had done some bad things, but he was tortured and said during the course of that torture that Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda were in league together, putting together weapons of mass destruction, and that was one of the planks on which Colin Powell and George Bush relied when they went into Iraq. So
he was sent to Egypt. He was captured in Afghanistan. He's a he ran an independent training camp. He wouldn't allow it to be taken over by al-Qaeda, so the Taliban shut it down. And they sent him to Egypt for torture after the FBI had been making some headway with proper rapport-building interrogation. The CIA came and took him and put him in a small box, put him on a plane, and I believe said, you know, while you're en route to where you're going, I'm going to find your mother, and you can imagine the rest of that sentence. And then he was waterboarded, I think, in Egypt, and came up with this false claim about connections between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, which, to his eternal shame, Colin Powell stood up and used addressing the UN the month before the illegal invasion of Iraq. So,
and we all know how well that went.
So, you know, that is what I would like to say to the British intelligence services, but they don't invite us into the room to discuss, you know, whether the glass is half full or half empty, and how dangerous it is to combat one perceived danger, which is the threat to the security of the United Kingdom, with another great danger, which is to start believing information that has been derived through the use of torture.
Do you think any lessons have been learned from that?
Yes, I think by and large we and the Americans have realised that flying people around the world to have them tortured is not a very good idea, but I'm not sure that that's the real... that's going to be one of the real legacies of 9/11. I think that increased secrecy, not just the banning of books in Guantanamo, but increased secrecy in the courts here and abroad, is something we're going to be settled with for a long time, I suspect.
And surveillance.
That's exactly what I was going to say. There's the sort of asymmetric thing, which goes that we get to know very little about what's going on in government, and government gets to know, you know, gets to put PRISM in place.
Yes.
In name and fact. And also there's the treatment of Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden and Thomas Drake, and, you know, the annihilation of anybody who... and, you know, Chelsea Manning did sign a number of acts, you know, so what she did actually was not illegal, but the reaction has been absolutely, you know, was absolutely extraordinary. And I think, as I say, the sort of... annihilation of those three people speaks to the response of power once it's been sort of, well, whistleblown on, I guess.
I did want to, if I could just make a point as well about, I mean, we've had some discussion here about the processes in the United States that have allowed information to be made publicly available, and there are certainly checks and balances in some ways that in certain areas are unthinkable here. I did an event with Philippe Sands, the lawyer, last week, where he was talking about the Senate intelligence report on the CIA torture program, and he said, you know, honestly, no way would that ever happen in this country. So that's a great thing that the United States has done. That said, when we're talking about secrecy, and I was talking about the review processes for allowing information out, I should note that there are 14 men who arrived in Guantanamo in September 2006 from the black sites. That was the day that George W. Bush went into the Rose Garden and said, you know the way I told you that we didn't have any secret prisons? Well, actually we did, but I've just closed them down and brought the guys to Guantanamo. Two more high-value detainees arrived after that. The presumptive classification of every word that these people have said to their lawyers is 100% sealed. Not a single word that any of those men have said to their lawyers since September 2006 has been allowed to be made public. And why? Well, all these guys were tortured. And it's part of the... you know, you can see when it comes to this, the extent to which the US government, notwithstanding the Senate intelligence report, wants to keep a lid on its own approach to what's happened and to try and avoid any accountability for that, which, you know... In the UK, with less transparency, we've just had by we're getting more and more secrecy involving the courts.
Well, that report, although it is remarkable that should be published, and it is a tremendous signifier of the strengths of the American political system of addressing its weaknesses, It is, of course, redacted. And we know that the British government has admitted that it consulted the committee before the redactions were put in place. So one of the purposes of the redactions, it seems, is to remove all reference to the United Kingdom and the United Kingdom's involvement in that whole programme. Where's Diego Garcia? Is there no reference to it anywhere? Well, I suspect it's behind a black line somewhere, maybe at the foot of page 140.
Yeah. Or in the however many thousand pages that haven't been published.
Absolutely, right, yeah. Absolutely.
So you're going to say something?
No.
So there are 122 men still in Guantanamo. Almost half were approved for transfer. There have been some transferred in the last few months. Can we call that progress, Andy?
We can definitely call it progress in the fact that 27 men have been released in the last 3 months, which is, you know, an extraordinary number given the snail's pace generally with which people have been released from Guantanamo over the last few years. You know, in large part because Congress has raised legislative obstacles. President Obama has always had it in his power to overcome those obstacles, but that would come at a political cost. And he hasn't been prepared to do that. So he spent most of a 3-year period sitting on his hands because Congress had made it difficult. The prisoners had to embark on a prison-wide hunger strike in 2013, which awoke the world's indignation in quite a significant way, actually, to put pressure on President Obama for him to get criticised, seriously criticised, the way that President Bush got criticised in his second term. And to make these moves towards releasing prisoners. But the last prisoner releases were over a month ago, and I'm not sure what's coming next. It's important. 54 of those men are men that the US government has said it doesn't want to carry on holding. Most of them through this task force that President Obama established, who reviewed the cases of all the prisoners in 2009 and delivered a final report 5 years ago, January 2010. Saying who should be prosecuted, who should be released, and these guys are still there. The majority of these people are from Yemen, and across the board the US establishment has refused to send anyone back to Yemen because of their fears about the security situation. Now, some of the men released in recent months are Yemenis, and some of them have been rehoused in third countries. They're not sending anyone home, but they're finding other countries to take them. So that's good, but you know, we constantly need to see more people being released to feel that there's genuinely progress.
So what can you do in your position, Claire, as a lawyer with your colleagues in the career?
Well, it's the thing that's incredibly difficult is that if you're talking about an individual guy who's trying to get out of Guantanamo, first of all, you have to, if let's say it's a Yemeni, and it's absolutely right, they can't go back to Yemen because of the security situation there. The problem is that in terms of guys who leave Guantanamo, the US still puts quite considerable conditions on their leaving. So, as it were, they have to check into a police station once a week. They have to, have electronic contact or whatever. But there are a significant number of conditions. So it's not necessarily an easy thing for a country to take a person. And then there's the problem that the State Department or whomever is not willing to say to the country that might be taking the guy, this is a really good guy. What they will say is, we believe that he was guilty of this. And so it's then very difficult to say to, as it were, Uruguay, this is what he was accused of, but he has now been cleared. And actually, so whilst the US clears people, it then doesn't do a huge amount of PR in terms of actually getting those people to third countries. And also after, there are large swathes of countries, frankly, after the Charlie Hebdo situation, most of Europe is now not terribly interested. South America, maybe. And there are countries that, as Andy said, that the US won't countenance people going back to in the Middle East and so forth. So the options are not that great.
So given that situation, Ian, what are we in prospect of seeing? Just years and years and years of this terrible institution still continuing to exist with people languishing in this state of limbo, holding limbo.
Well, I'd hesitate to guess what the future might hold, or you just ask me to do so, and I guess that has to be a possibility, doesn't it? And it was very clear by early 2002 that they had themselves over a real barrel. And they couldn't see themselves that they'd grab this barrel from anywhere and completely unnecessarily and put themselves over it. And early 2002, people were asking themselves, well, how long are you going to hold them? And are you thinking the world will just forget them? You can't kill them all, you know. So, it's a real problem for them, isn't it? It's a tremendous problem. But it's entirely, if it's 9 a month being released, by the end of next year, you know,
But the problem, I think, the reason that it was 9 a month is because we're about to have a Republican controlled America in terms of the House and the Senate, and they're going to bring in an NDA, an act which will make it impossible for more people to leave.
So, what's Obama got to lose then? Why can't he just go ahead and do it?
Well, he may veto this. I mean, the bill that has been proposed by the right wing senators, which is called the Protecting America from Terrorists Act 2015. For the prisoners in Guantanamo, essentially banning anyone from being released until after the end of the Obama presidency, he's threatened to veto. Now, you know, given that there are 54 people that the US says it doesn't want to hold, and it's done that at a high level, you know, a review board established by the president, a task force, that's up against lawmakers who are deciding that actually that task force is wrong and that these people are dangerous. So maybe President Obama will use a veto. I think he needs to do. Mm. I think there are people in his administration who are aware that it's a legacy issue, aware that, you know, on day two, back in 2009, he said, I'm going to close this place, and he hasn't done it.
So this is where I do my beaten wife thing. Because when he first came in, and there was the, you know, there was the executive order, and we had a party in the office, and we were, hey. And one of my funders,
so did the prisoners.
Yeah, one of my funders called me and was like, do we need to fund you anymore? And I was like, maybe not. Maybe we're all redundant. God, how exciting would that be? And I was like, why don't we just hang on and see how it all works out? Then it came, you know, then we got halfway through the first term. We were kind of like, well, maybe Obama kind of meant it but didn't quite do it, and maybe he can't do it in his first term, and maybe he'll do it at the beginning of the second term, and then the beginning, because he'll otherwise be unelectable, and then the beginning of the second term came around, you're like, well, maybe he'll do it at the end of the second term, and it is just that thing of like, when is the guy going to do what he said he's going to do? And I really hope that he has the gumption
I mean, and given as, you know, you just mentioned the climate in Europe now after Charlie Hebdo, and obviously the huge concerns about Islamic State and the power of Islamic State in Iraq and Syria and where that's going to go. You talked earlier, Ian, about thinking that they, you know, intelligence services have to an extent learned their lessons, but we are going to see secrecy. Can we really see an end to rendition and these secret prisons?
Not completely, I suspect, is the answer to that. We are still involved in various odd goings on in East Africa. Mm-hmm. I say we British have been since the 2010 election, although not being involved in the abusive practices that the last government was in Egypt, Pakistan, Bangladesh, anywhere you like, really. And there are still secret prisons, of course, aren't there? There's one in Djibouti, it seems. And so no, we haven't completely seen the end of it. And so we need to keep on working. We need to keep on exposing what's going
not
on.
Not redundant yet.
Not redundant for a while, I suspect.
And as a human rights lawyer, has this felt like a particularly bleak period? I mean, obviously, being a human rights lawyer, life is always
I was going to say.
To an extent, isn't it?
You've got to be pretty optimistic.
But given that,
the depressing thing actually is having a Democratic president do it, because weirdly, like when Bush was doing it, it felt like there were votes to be won by saying it was a bad thing. And I think Obama came in, weirdly, as Ian was talking, I was like, the problem is there are no votes in it. Like, there's no votes in Obama closing Guantanamo, I don't think. And the depressing thing is that when he came in on this wash of saying that he was going to do the right thing and, you know, being that person. But it's almost like he's not going to win that many votes now by doing it, because the world feels like it's in a different place, and the Republicans sure as hell aren't going to put it on their agenda. So that I think feels like, and also I remember talking to someone in America about this, and he was saying the problem is if you've got a Democratic president doing this stuff, all of the politicians who would normally be complaining about it, who are Democrats, aren't complaining about it because their boss is in the White House. So that's a bit depressing.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, Obama and his administration have steadfastly refused to send anyone new to Guantanamo. Mm. They have dealt with the prison as a legacy.
I'm droning them all.
Yes.
Well, that's the new policy, isn't it?
That, of course, is true. But in terms of, you know, the key issue with Guantanamo, which is kind of important in this year of the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta in this country, and let's watch out for some unbelievable hypocrisy from our government, is the principle of habeas corpus, which, of course, you know, 800 years ago started just with the barons and eventually was extended to include everybody, that we have the right not to be chucked in a dungeon and have the key thrown away by whoever it is who's decided they're the absolute monarch. And that's the situation at Guantanamo, essentially. The one that Shaka Armour, the last British resident who's still held, finds himself in. You know, Obama hasn't sent anyone new there. Republicans, every time somebody's captured who's a terrorist suspect, they want to send someone new. So to that extent, it is a legacy issue. It's been difficult to deal with for a variety of reasons. I mean, you know, a lack of the strength on President Obama's part, but, you know, massive unprincipled opposition from Republicans. And it's an example of how colossal the damage is when you take all the laws and treaties that stand and tear them up into little pieces like the Bush administration did. Mm. So, you know, I don't entirely believe that we'll see it forever, but it would help if he does think about his legacy and, you know, what's right, and before his presidency ends, you know, does some executive orders if that's what's required to actually move on this, but we'll see.
I think, yeah, I agree with that, absolutely, but I do think, you know, when we were over there, a guy called Mike Mukasey, who was one of George Bush's attorney generals, said, you know, if you don't let us detain and interrogate these guys, we're just going to kill them. And I think that there is a kind of 2.0 of Guantanamo, which is, you know, the drones and the proxy detention, the not capturing people and torturing them, but giving counter-terror money to Somalia, to wherever, and having the counter-terror units within those police forces capture and torture people who the US points at. And we've had that happen with one of our guys in Yemen, where there was an American guy in Yemen studying Islam, and basically he was picked up by the Yemeni counter-terror police, which were funded by the US, and then interrogated by the US. So I think that even if there aren't secret prisons, it's kind of going back to how it was done under the CIA years ago.
There's a kind of bigger issue, isn't there, here, of how we need a, not an anti-war movement, maybe we need an anti-dirty war movement, because that's what, you know, the UK is involved in, that's what the US is involved in. And yet we don't have any great political presence that wants to, you know, save us a vast amount of money and enable us to once more perhaps stand on a very small box marked moral high ground. Because it seems that everything we've been doing since 9/11, you know, almost everywhere that we go and kill people, they're Muslims, and we wonder why we're making enemies. And it goes on and on. You know, the latest round of having to go back into Iraq because of what we created in the first place by going into Iraq illegally just takes us into such absurd territory that I would love a major peace movement to begin. You know, in all of our countries in the West where, you know, we're the warmongers and we're doing the killing and then we're getting the blowback.
And the great difficulty is...
That's my idealism, yeah.
Well, no, I mean, the great difficulty is, isn't it, is about the current climate and the way that... So, for example, around the surveillance legislation, that you just have to say the word national security and terrorism and everyone rolls over. So, for example, last summer we saw this, you know, that, you know, America did respond much, much more quickly than Parliament did here to the implications of the Snowden revelations. But then we saw Parliament last summer just pushing through this emergency legislation, and all the parties rolled over, didn't they?
Yes, and really what we should do is whenever we hear the words national security and terrorism, instead of rolling over, we should sit upright and thinking, Why are these bastards lying to us again? It's my view. We should really think very carefully about what it is.
Can we start replacing every time we see national security with exactly that? Why are these bastards lying to us? That would be great. Let's all go away and do that. See what happens.
Well, or at least replace national security with national embarrassment.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Which is usually the case, isn't it?
It's actually not remotely relevant. I was going to say on the peace thing, I was driving down the Euston Road the other day and saw the Quaker building, and I think it's its 100-year anniversary or something, and it said, "Quakers, still working for peace." It's just starting to sound slightly passive-aggressive. Still at it. But anyway.
Do any of you have questions? Yes, one here.
It strikes me as no coincidence that... a lot of the most articulate and most charismatic detainees, like Shaka Amar, like Muhammad Islam, are the ones who are still not being released, despite the fact that they clearly pose no threat. I don't think there's anyone in the Obama administration who thinks that they really do, militarily speaking. So that then begs the question, well, is it because they pose a threat as a total PR disaster if they are released? And then by extension, could that not be one of the reasons why so many works of literature are being denied in business? Because they don't want to give the detainees the opportunity to get an education and become articulate so that when they're released, they'll be so effective at criticising the administration.
Sounds very credible, Andy.
Yeah, it might be. I mean, on the first point, I think it's very important for people to recognise that people who... are considered a risk because they're capable of articulating what's happened to them in a way that other people will understand. Aslahi has so clearly demonstrated, as Shaka Amar's demonstrated in his words. We don't hear from some of the other prisoners in Guantanamo who are pretty much locked up permanently in isolation like Shaka is, because when they're put in with the general population, they start agitating for resistance to the oppression that the prisoners are suffering. There are a number of those prisoners. I know years ago there were about 10 guys who were spending a lot of time in isolation. The majority of those are still there, I think. They may have modified their behaviour so that they're now in general population, because that is the best way, I think, certainly for being approved for release, even if that may not actually lead to you being released, but not being regarded as an internal threat within the prison, is to become compliant. And certainly there's a process underway at the moment. As well as the 54 men approved for release, there are 68 others, so 10 of those are facing trials or have been tried. 58 others are slowly going through a process, another review process, for how many have there been, called the periodic review boards. But this time round, the purpose of these review boards is to give the prisoners an opportunity to demonstrate that they can mitigate the risk that they could be perceived as causing simply by being Guantanamo prisoners, which of course is such a dangerous concept. So they're being given an opportunity, they're being given military representatives to help them frame this, their lawyers out of them, and say, look, you know, I've got family, I want to find a job, I want to get married, I want to go back to my family, I will be a productive member of society, I will not bear a grudge against the United States. There's this whole process going on, which is part of the thing that the men who pose a threat to them by their thoughts and words find difficult, I think. You know, and that's what so much of it is about in Guantanamo, is how you have behaved while you have been so horribly and unjustly detained.
Most of the British people who were locked up in Guantanamo have very quietly gone on with their lives, as far as I can see. So the guys from Tipton are now sort of fitting radiators in Tipton, you know, Black Country in Birmingham. The exception, of course, is Bawazen Beg, who's spoken very publicly about about the injustice that he suffered. I know that senior security officials, British security officials, have been very angry about the way in which he just doesn't go away and stay quiet. So early last year, he was arrested, and he was released. He spent 7 months on remand. He was released after it became clear that the security service had something of a disclosure problem. It's not just that they weren't disclosing materials to the defence; they weren't actually disclosing materials to the police and the Crown Prosecution Service, which, when disclosed, showed that the prosecution couldn't be sustained. So after 7 months, he was released, and the police privately and the Crown Prosecution Service very publicly criticised the failure of disclosure on the part of MI5. MI5 were one of the drivers behind the prosecution, the investigation and prosecution of Noisenberg, after they had expressed privately their concern about their anger about the fact that he was speaking up. And he appears to have been stitched up completely.
Yeah, that was really disgraceful.
Because that's considered rescinding, isn't it?
Sorry?
That's considered rescinding, isn't it?
That's because...
Rescinding.
The fact that they were particularly angry that he turned up and he was going to Syria, that really bothered them, that the man that, you know, the man that had been in Guantanamo for so many years had the nerve to go to Syria and come back and write and talk about it. Mm-hmm. That bothered them greatly.
And they wanted to send a message out to young Muslims to not go to Syria, and what better way than to put this high-profile Muslim in prison for 7 months? I think that was, must have been a key part of it as well.
It was a horrible thing to do to Muslims as well, because having spent that time in Guantanamo, I mean, he's an incredibly strong man. But
and it's worth explaining that what it was that they failed to disclose with the evidence that they had, that he was being completely candid about with the security service and talking to them about his trip to Syria. They didn't give the police and the Crown Prosecution Service their minutes of their meeting with Muwaddenberg, in which he explained what he was doing in Syria and why.
There's a question there.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask more about the censorship and the sort of different way, spectrum of looking at it, is from incompetence to very carefully managed. And I wonder whether, for instance, there are any sort of manuals of censorship as to how you do the process. I'm sort of reminded of having been to Israel, how you can either look at Israeli security as being very efficient or being extremely inefficient, because it seems to be very random now. It could be the very randomness of this is the thing that controls people the best.
That's what Stalin said.
I did actually. It just reminded me of something. Actually, I lived in Jerusalem many years ago, and I heard that. I actually found myself in a very interesting position teaching the Merchant of Venice to a Palestinian girl who was, in my spare time, who was studying it at school, and then discovered at the same time that it was banned in the occupied territories.
Is it about the Merchant of Venice?
Are they sharing the same banned books list?
I wrote a piece about it, and I remember talking to the Israeli army and trying to get to the bottom of the censorship there, and they kind of did, they thought, what? Merchant? Of course not. No, they all denied it, completely denied it and said there was no policy. So there it was just a completely slippery thing. But I've never come across a manual of...
No, it's a lovely idea. There must be such a thing, and it would be wonderful, actually. I shall put that on my to-do list. It would be wonderful to find it and get it out there, because that would be awesome.
I'm pretty convinced there are different people doing different things. So that, one department somewhere is banning books. Another, the privilege review team is in a pretty haphazard way deciding what and what not to allow to be unclassified. And then the people who are very much on the case with the high value detainees to try and make sure that not a single word that any of them say ever gets out. And then, of course, over the years, they've just ended up in a bit of a pickle, really, because the spanner in the works for them, although the right wing have used it to their advantage, was the files that were released by WikiLeaks, that Chelsea Manning released, the classified military files from Guantanamo, which contain a lot of information. The right wingers actually have been using it to their advantage, because they claim that every word in it is truth, when almost the opposite is true. They're just packed full of lies and distortions told by people who, like Salahi, were tortured, or you put pressure on people, they tell you lies. But lawyers aren't allowed to use these files, even though they're publicly available. They're not allowed to actually use them. So there have been a lot of those weird censorship issues in recent years, where things that are publicly available are not allowed to be used by lawyers because they were supposed to have remained classified.
I think Stalin said something along the lines of what you said in terms of the way in which to inspire fear is to be inconsistent. So
exactly.
One of the things that I've found is I find myself reading redacted documents quite a bit. I was reading one set of the Crown Prosecution Service's office on Monday afternoon, and sometimes I read stuff through FOI, which is redacted. And some of the redactions, when they're carried out online, are not completely effective, and there is a way with some programmes of actually working out what's behind the redactions, but I'm not going to tell you what it is because they'll shut it down. Yeah. But of course, if it's done properly, you get a piece of paper, you black it out with a pen, and then you scan it in, and that's it. That's redacted properly then. If you use an online redaction tool, then maybe it's not always going to work. So you have to know, you have to have a guess at what's behind it, but once you start searching sometimes for something, it'll show you where it is within the redacted document that particular word has been redacted. Mm. So which is great fun.
There's a question here.
To what extent does the Guantanamo book ban reflect what occurs in domestic supermax prisons anyway? Thinking, I know, like ADX Florence banned Barack Obama's biography, and there's all the gang validation stuff in California, so books like Machiavelli and George Jackson would be get you in solitary. And asking that at a broader level, to what extent is Guantanamo a continuation of the domestic supermax system, and to what extent is it an aberration?
That's a really interesting question.
So it is, yeah.
I have no idea.
I don't know the answer, I'm afraid.
I would imagine they're related, actually, you know, but I don't know whether it's the same people. I would just imagine the same processes are at work, that people are, I mean, specifically you're giving examples of books that, given the actual type of people who are being held, are books that, you know, well, you don't want to give these to these particular people because they're going to find those inspirational. But I would imagine it's pretty hit and miss across the board unless you're enforcing an absolute ban. Because, you know, to return to what I think there's a lot of incompetence, but there you go.
Chris Grayling did something, didn't he, a little while ago, where he tried to ban books altogether.
We had a
but
campaign,
that was,
a pen,
yes,
that
right.
reported on, so, but it was a very... It's sort of,
but he was saying it was because people were smuggling drugs in via the books.
Well, it was just
something.
Such nonsense. It was very funny. Actually, I remember they made this policy, which is essentially that family and friends could not send books into, you know, to their friends and loved ones. And so it's effectively, it was a book ban.
Mm.
And they denied, Grayling denied all the, again, kind of a semantic game, he denied all the way through that they'd ever banned anything, when, of course, they had. And then they kept on making up justifications that changed all the time. One of the justifications was that sort of people would smuggle drugs. And there was this fantastic ex-governor of Brixton who said, well, on that basis, they should ban the prison offices because that's where most of the drugs are found.
And most of the bones are brought in by prison officers as well.
And there again, I just think it's so interesting. I just think, in, you know, whenever books are banned, it says so much about a very twisted idea of, and very sort of, I think, oversimplified idea of the harm that books can do, or how people will use information, and X plus X will lead to Z, which is treats people as if they're sort of robots. It's a very sort of stupid, really, way of looking at the human race.
And it completely neglects the, as I understand it, data which says that the likelihood of recidivism is reduced by literacy and, you know, all that
stuff. Absolutely, well, of course. And
well, sometimes there's a punishment angle, though, isn't there? You know, and I think when,
yes.
You know, when people in government in this country, you know, look like, sound like, and behave like unenlightened Victorians, then there is a punishment angle of letting
them. Yes, of course.
Why do these people have any perks?
Yes. You know, yes, of course. Of course. Yeah, no, but sort of completely short sighted.
I had a couple questions, so I'll make one really short. The thing that surprised me most about the book ban was that people in Guantanamo Bay had books. To what extent might this just be a PR exercise to make people realise they can read some things? Secondly, was getting onto your point about the future of Guantanamo earlier. We just had the release that Black Site Black, I think it was in Poland. And a lot of the redactions in the torture report were in relation to people and countries. So as we get more of these kind of releases about where the Black Sites were, do you think it's more likely that Guantanamo detainees will be released because they don't have this information that seems to be so prevalently important?
I'll go with a bit of an answer on one of them, which is which comes back to Shaka, which is one of Andy's great campaigns. I can't work out why Shaka isn't out, and people and Clive, my amazing boss and founder, keeps on saying it's because he knows. You know, it's because he knows. And the problem is that there are quite a lot of people out now who know. You know, and. You know, it's definitely the case. Shaka was the fifth guy in Bagram. He was there at the beginning. He saw some. He was tortured hideously. He saw some hideous stuff. Indeed, I think he saw Al Libby being carried out in the box. And one of Clive's theories is that the reason that Shaka isn't out is because he has information around this stuff. But as you say, I mean, the more it comes out, the less credible that is. And so I'm not sure that more information coming out necessarily equates to people getting out, although I can, you know, I can see why that ought to be the case. I think, depressingly, it's more the case that people aren't getting out either because there's nowhere for them to go and countries aren't accepting them, or because I'm slightly worried that the reason Shaka isn't out is just because he's been a bit mouthy and everybody hates him, basically. I mean, in terms of the Guantanamo apparatchik. I can't remember the other bits of the question, so I'll show
you. Your first book was about the library. I just remember in the... In the early days, so, well, not that early, but quite a long time ago now, so probably about 2006, 2007. At the time, my understanding from what came out of Guantanamo was that there was a very small trolley that was wheeled around that had, you know, a handful of books and magazines that nobody wanted to read, and that constituted the library. So things have obviously developed since then, as they've developed in a lot of ways, you know, generally under Obama, for people who are perceived as being well-behaved, that's the important thing, that there are more perks. You know, but, I mean, we could probably look at what well-behaved prisoners are allowed to watch, for example, which I think was, you know, there's only a certain programs that they're allowed to watch. So is it called World's Deadliest Catch? some macho fishing program. I think maybe Ice Road Truckers. I mean, you know, but things that are political are generally frowned on, although some of them are now allowed to watch the news sometimes. It's
Russia Today, apparently, is apparently extremely... It's very funny, but there's apparently an extremely hot producer on Russia Today who sort of does this whole kind of pillow. And all of these extremely, you know... religious men, apparently, very respectfully, very much like Labour and Philip. So Russia Today, apparently, very, very popular.
This kind of punches the hardened extremists.
The really annoying thing is that Clive always insists that everybody goes on Russia Today, and I kind of have something of an issue with Russia Today, not being, you know, wholly owned, etc. But Clive's like, no, you have to go because all the clients will see you.
So,
anyway.
I don't know that... Can't offer an answer to your second question, but your first one, I'm kind of surprised by some of the books. I'm not surprised that books are allowed in, but some of the books that are allowed in do surprise me. Mm. So 1984 is permitted, and so is Kafka's The Trial. That's permitted as well, which is that really surprising. You know, spoiler alert here, for anybody who hasn't read The Trial is planning to do so, you should put your fingers in your ears and really see what happens at the end. The trial, of course, ends with the man who's on trial, Joseph K., is it being executed. So that's kind of surprised me that they would have that book in a fairly gruesome fashion. So that kind of surprised me. But this afternoon, I found myself wondering, what did we, the British, do when we interned people? Strictly speaking, when the Northern Ireland government interned people without trial in 1971 with the support of the British government, were those internees allowed books? And so I went and there's a book written by one of the people who was interned on day one, a guy called John McGuffin, and I had a quick look at that, and he indeed says that yes, they were allowed to read books. Books were sent in, and food was sent in by their families, but only to be taken away from them again whenever there was a disturbance.
Yeah.
The guards would come into their cells and just rip off everybody's books. So it was another sort of means of control.
Full spectrum dominance.
Yes.
I was wondering whether there have been any whistleblowers from the side of the guards. I mean, you'd expect them to. In over the space of 30 years, that someone might have tried to
break ranks and tell the story from that side? Or have they managed to suppress that story entirely? Because it would be a pretty comprehensive exercise to do that if that's what's happened.
I think at least one book has been written by the Guard and was published published quite late last
year.
The problem, there was we had a slightly unfortunate situation where we had a guard who was exactly that, who we brought over to do a talk, and possibly unsurprisingly, he was a bit of a nutter. He was interesting, really interesting, in terms of talking about interrogation techniques. But he then went on to deny that 9/11 had taken place, and you're just like, oh, marvellous. You have a room full of people, and we were all doing so well, and suddenly it's like, clearly the CIA planned the Twin Towers, and you're just like, oh.
There is a book that came out on the same day as Salahi's book, actually, I think is when he came out, which is called Death in Camp Delta, or Murder in Camp Delta.
That's the one.
Which is by former Staff Sergeant Joseph Hickman. The story actually came out in Harper's Magazine five years ago. It's taken until now for the book to come out, which adds some new information. He basically was in charge of the people in the guard tower. So the night that three men allegedly committed suicide simultaneously in June 2006, he is absolutely convinced and convincing about saying this couldn't have happened because he saw the movement of people. And it's well worth seeing because this is a whole sordid story in Guantanamo's generally sordid history that deserves more exposure. There have been other guards who publicly spoken out. There's a man called Brandon Neely who came from just an ordinary kind of military police background, who went to Guantanamo, then went to Iraq, then years later found himself having sleepless nights about what he'd done and started investigating it. He's on Twitter a lot, and he's very interesting. There's a guy who converted to Islam called Terry Holbrooks. There's a guy who came over and did a tour with Mozam and Cage Prisoners a few years ago, who was a kind of white trash skater kid, I think is his own definition of himself. Who'd been accepted in the National Guard, even though he was like tiny and puny and clearly alternative. But he was very bright as well, so they put him on the assignment of the frequent flyer program. It's a horrible part of Guantanamo's story, where they moved people around every few hours from cell to cell to stop them sleeping. A sleep deprivation program. But it involved somebody being clever enough to work out how you could move people from cell to cell. So they put him on it until he realized what he was doing. And then he was absolutely appalled. Mm. Privately, dozens and dozens of former guards have communicated with former prisoners to personally apologise for what they did.
Really?
But have not gone public with it. And a lot of the time people don't go public with it because they're either still in the military or they're in the position of wanting to keep their pensions or whatever.
That would be a good book.
Mm. There was a top military lawyer who thought the Guardian ran a piece, I can't remember his name, when you published Mohammed Ould Salahi's, and he resigned, do you remember, because he was so appalled.
Oh, Stuart Couch, the prosecutor.
Yes.
He was supposed to be his prosecutor,
yes.
Yeah.
Significant.
And they do go often. There was a military nurse who refused to be involved in force feeding and did the kind of, I will not be involved, and they sued him and are trying to remove his pension at the moment. Mm. So, and he's, a nurse, so.
But with Salahi, somebody got in touch with me when that habeas decision in his favour was first passed, which was 5 years ago. I got an email from somebody who said, I was at Guantanamo, I was a guard at Guantanamo. For several months, I was looking after Salahi, so I got to know him quite well. I'm absolutely convinced that there is, not a bad bone in this guy's body. He's totally not guilty of anything that he's been accused of. So I got back to him, do you want to go public with this? No, he didn't, but, That I've had a few of these, but I know that Mozam, for example, has had dozens of people get in touch. So I think, across the spectrum of people released, there's a lot of people. And it's understandable, you have to understand, really, these people are essentially brainwashed into believing that, these guys are the worst of the worst, and,
they were responsible for 9/11.
Yeah, they do a six-month tour. And, Omar De Gaias, once said, the problem is that a lot of them, by the time their 6 months was up, were starting to realise that they'd been told a pack of lies, but then they were moved out. Mm-hmm. And then another bunch of kids came in who were brainwashed, and the whole thing started again.
Mm-hmm. Right, and one more question. Anyone has another question?
So, but just on that last question, I was thinking about it earlier, I was at a lecture by Brian Stevenson, the American human rights lawyer who works a lot of death row prisoners, and he talks about, you know, the first step for sort of getting people their rights and, you know, achieving humanity is this proximity. The minute you get close to people, actually try and understand them, the people you maybe fear, see as the enemy, that's the first step. And it's so obvious when you hear someone say it, that that's when the fear goes away, when you get close. And I was wondering, when you were talking earlier, how the guards had reacted, because it seems to me that in such an isolated place, once you have that proximity, that would happen. But as you say, the sort of 6-monthly...
Presumably, if the guards are willing to let their defences down, then now they might be able to talk to more and more of the prisoners because they all speak English, but in the early days they didn't. But one of the guards who turned against his brainwashing, you know, he had been talking to the Tipton three guys from the West Midlands, the British guys who were held in Guantanamo, and he said he had a revelation. He just started thinking something's not right here, because he was sharing his packet of Skittles with a guy who spoke perfect English to him, and they were talking about the rap music that they liked. Of course, it did his head in.
And these incoming guards, maybe it would be far harder for them to deny to themselves the basic humanity, the essential humanity of their charges, if they see them reading poetry and the rights of man. You know, that's maybe that's part of what it is. There's a guy I know who he was in the IRA, and he went to jail for life. And when he came out, he became a journalist, and but he was on the blanket and all the rest of it. And he, while serving his life sentence, he described how a couple of journalists were being shown around the prison where he was, and they looked at his bookshelf and they could see he was reading Dostoevsky. So they said, "What are you doing reading Dostoevsky?" And he had to say to them, "Well, what is an IRA man doing reading Dostoevsky?" And he said, "Well, IRA men are human beings." So, and it seemed to be quite a jolt to the visitors.
Well, that's a good line to end on. So I'd like to thank Ian Cobain, Claire Elgar, Andy Worthington, and all of you for your brilliant questions. Thank you very much.